Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Brent Lorenz, a vice president at McLane Group's headquarters office. Is it Lorenz or Lawrence?
Either way, Lorenz is fine.
I just want to make sure I get it right. Thanks for being a special guest today. Brent provides merger and acquisition advisory services to middle market software and engineering services firms. You're an engineer, right?
I'm an electrical engineer by training.
Holy moly. You know, I'm intimidated across the table. In particular, he focuses on working with companies in markets such as cybersecurity, embedded software and semiconductors, and GUI, graphical user interface.
That's right.
Data visualization is another area that he works in, imaging, networking infrastructure software. And he's a member of the McLane Group's technology and telecommunications and aerospace, defense, and government M&A practices. Prior to joining McLane Group, Brent spent about 15 years working in the tech industry, including companies such as Texas Instruments, IBM Software Group, and a venture capital startup or two. And he's had a long history of working with embedded software firms, including Wind River. I have a client that probably worked with you. And Telogy Networks and Trinity Convergence. So without further ado, Brent, you've got a really interesting background. And it's very different from what I see with typical investment bankers who are finance geeks or, you know, MBAs out of this, that, or the other. How did you get into investment banking?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. I would have to admit I probably do have about the most roundabout path for getting into investment banking. The short answer is I went from being a sales engineer to a semiconductor product manager and a retail franchise entrepreneur to investment banker. Uh-huh. And originally, I studied electrical engineering, and I was hired by Texas Instruments to join their technical sales training program. And they like to hire, you know, guys with engineering degrees, guys and gals, and send them out to do technical sales to talk to engineers. And my primary career was technology sales, business development, and product management for about 15 years, as you mentioned. And I was at big companies like TI and IBM. I was also at some small companies that were venture capital funded. It was also during this time that at the University of Maryland, I earned an MBA, and I started thinking a lot about entrepreneurship and small business, and that it would be fun to either be, you know, an entrepreneur or work with entrepreneurs. It just sounded pretty exciting. So one of the steps that I took is I decided to dip my toes in the water of entrepreneurship and actually own a business. And so I bought a retail franchise, which was a general nutrition center franchise that was
hold on
local.
A second. You bought a retail franchise?
I did. I bought a GNC franchise too.
Why? You're an engineer.
Yeah.
What do you know about nutrition?
I was an athlete. I actually had a college scholarship to a junior college for a year. And so I've always been interested in health and sports and nutrition. It's sort of a little side hobby of mine. And actually, I bought a business that I shopped at, and I just thought it was exciting and interesting. And I wanted to dip my toe in the water without quitting my day job, and so this was a perfect way to do that. And
how did it go?
Yeah, it went well. I mean, I didn't hit a home run, but it's kind of hard to hit a home run with one small
store.
You either got to buy a bunch of them, you have to scale it up.
You were a franchisee?
I was a franchisee, yeah. So it's kind of entrepreneurship light is the way I'd explain
it. That's a good way to cut your teeth in the business like that. So so you did that. And then from franchising, where did you go from there?
Well, it was right around this time I started thinking about doing M&A work and that it'd be a lot of fun. It had been kind of in the back of my mind that it'd be something I'd like to pursue. It just took me a while to bite the bullet. And part of the reason why I chose franchising to start with, because I was never the creative guy that was going to take an idea and start a business from scratch. And I have so much credit or respect for folks that do that.
Right.
But I'm more of a sales and finance and execution kind of guy. So this was a good way to get started. And, there's an old saying that the two best days of your life are the day you bought your boat and sold your boat. And it's an old joke I tell too many times, but for me, those days were the day I bought my business and sold my business. And so it was just a lot more fun to put on a name tag or to buy it and sell it than it was to put on a name tag and actually, you know, run it every day.
Yeah, that's tough. Retailing, I grew up in retailing, and it's a hard business to be in. So unless you really want to spend the long hours and cultivate the customer relationships and do it day after day after day, year after year, it can be a long grind. grind. It can be very difficult.
And if you want it to be your primary career, you need to go for something, a swing for the fences, and go for something big enough that you could actually make a living at, or that you can scale upwards and buy 10 of them or something like that.
Well, you worked for Texas Instruments, you worked for IBM. Those are big companies, and they're great companies. Right. They have great, you know, training. What are some of the biggest advantages and lessons that you learned, and how do you apply them today at McLane Group?
Right. Well, I mean, the answers, the reasons why there are good places to be are things that you'd kind of expect. I mean, they're big, stable companies, and primarily if you're a sales engineer or doing business development, they have products that people want, and so you get a lot of doors open, you get to talk to a lot of people because of the reputation of the company. And so it's great experience to get your feet wet and, you know, business and the right way to do things, and so it was good experience for that regard.
So, and the training, I imagine, is pretty good there too.
Very good. Yeah. You know, there's an old saying that, you know, when TI hires you out of college, they send you down to Texas to lobotomize you and send you off into the world. But it's true. I mean, that you go down for the training program, you spend a year to 2 years and just learning about technology and how to sell. And it's great for people with engineering backgrounds coming out of college. So it was a great start.
So how would you compare your experience in a big giant company like IBM or TI and a venture capital startup,
right,
which I've worked with many over my career, and I understand how interesting that can be as well.
Right. Well, it's very different. I mean, it's a much different risk-reward ratio. You never know if the company is going to hit it big or go out of business the next week. You know, working in those startups, you can get a lot of broader responsibility much more quickly. You have to be much more creative about how to get things done. And that's the kind of environment that you want to be able to thrive in if you're going to be happy there. It's not about the money or the potential trade-off. It's that you enjoy doing that. And sometimes you just have to make decisions and beg for forgiveness later.
What did you do at the venture capital startups?
I did business development and technical sales at both of them.
Because you're an engineer, you understand the products that they were developing. Was it you mentioned it was voice over IP and those types of products?
Yeah, both of them were voice over IP related. One was more on the enterprise level, which was managing Cisco IP telephony gear. And then the other side was more embedded, meaning that it was, you know, baked into the chipset of like a TI or an Intel chip.
Understood. And that's something you were very familiar with. So you owned a retail franchise.
Right.
That's a very different experience. What are some of the best lessons that you learned out of owning your own business?
Right. I think there's two lessons that I learned. You know, first of all, because I acquired it and I didn't build it from scratch, I saw the business sale process from the perspective of the buyer originally. And so I knew when I took it over that I would need to pay attention of every detail and how it flows through the income statement and future valuation, so that in the future when I was ready to sell it, that, you know, I had all the control knobs built in. So, you know, every decision that I made, I needed to pay attention to that. And that's probably lesson number one, is to, you know, from day one, make sure that you're thinking about the long-term exit, maybe if it's not even for 5 or 10 years. Number two is, another lesson I learned is, you know, swing for the fences, you know, pick something that's big enough that you can, you know, make a nice living or, you know, even get wealthy by hitting a home run. And it's kind of hard to do it part-time on the side.
Yeah, definitely. You got to devote your whole time if you're going to make it a success. Right. Tell me about McLane Group. I know a lot about the firm. I've worked closely with them. I actually do some work for you guys, and I know a lot of your partners. Tell me what you're doing today.
Sure.
What types of projects you're getting involved with there?
Sure, yeah. So today I'm an investment banker with the McLane Group. We're based in Tyson's Corner. It's been around since about 1997, done hundreds of deals. The key value proposition to my role in the firm is that I have a lot of experience both on the technology side of things as also as a small business owner. And there's a lot of folks at the McLane Group that didn't come through a traditional finance path, kind of like myself. And so we offer a lot of real world business experience that sometimes you don't get when you just follow the standard finance path. We're a middle market M&A firm primarily, meaning that, you know, we focus on mergers and acquisitions when shareholders are looking for some sort of an exit, and we act as the intermediary.
So middle market is what size?
Yeah, good question. Almost everybody has a different definition of what that means. And a good rule of thumb would be is if you're looking at a company that's worth $500 million or more, that's typically going to be served by Wall Street. If you're looking at a business that's a retail mom and pop, like my GNC franchise, that's probably going to be served by a business broker. And then we do stuff that's in between. You know, maybe it's worth $10 to $100 million is a good rule of thumb.
Okay. And so you're focusing on technology,
that's right,
merger and acquisition. What are the segments that are most active in M&A right now in the technology market?
Well, overall, we see a lot of action in cybersecurity, We see a lot of action in data visualization and analysis and cloud computing.
Okay. Are you seeing an uptick in activity right now because of the fear that tax rates are going to go up next year?
We are. I mean, 2012 has been a little bit of a soft year for M&A in general, and you can read just about any report that'll tell you that. But we are seeing an uptick of deals trying to get under the finish line at the end of 2012 because, you know, capital gains taxes are expected to go up by a fair amount in addition to potentially other taxes. And so a lot of deals are getting done now that kind of, you know, it'll swing the average a little higher for the end of the year.
Okay, good. Now, technology companies I've worked with for 30 years over my career, and how do they differ from the typical government contractor? I mean, there are technology companies right. that are government contractors. There are those that aren't. How do they differ? What distinguishes them?
Yeah, the main difference is how they're valued. So when you take a contractor to market, I mean, they're primarily going to be valued based upon a multiple of earnings or EBITDA, right? And they're going to receive a premium for things like large prime contracts, cleared, you know, security clearances, highly cleared work. If they have some sort of, you know, differentiated IP along with the with their services work, but it boils down to a multiple of earnings, and then that control knob gets turned up or down based upon, you know, how unique is that work that they're doing.
Okay. What about technology companies?
And technology product companies are typically, again, valued differently because they're much more scalable. And you can.
So how do you value a company that has a product that may or may not be patentable, but it's
right.
got something that's really cool?
Well, ultimately, it's worth whatever the buyer will pay for it.
There you go.
But
well, that was easy. Because I know you guys do valuation work, and I was just thinking to myself, how do you value that? It's got to be based on some kind of cash flow stream that's being generated from the product, right?
I mean, that's the fundamental way to value any business is the cash flow, the EBITDA earnings stream.
Right.
But when you're talking about a strategic buyer buying IP, then you know, it's typically based off of a multiple of revenue. And then there's strategic considerations about, you know, frankly, what can they do with the technology and how can they scale it into maybe it's millions of units a year to enable them to sell more phones or more switches or whatever the case may be.
Well, when we're talking about valuation, how does McLean Group go about advising a potential client, say, about what their business might be worth in a potential deal or an acquisition coming down the pike?
Right. I mean, there's a couple of ways that we do that. First of all, we subscribe to a lot of expensive databases that cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's not cheap to get into. And so what we do with that information is we update clients by providing newsletters and database white papers, those types of things that clients can opt in or opt out of. And you also mentioned that we have a business valuation practice, which is quite large for the area. And one of the things we can do is sort of anonymously aggregate that data and give clients guidance without, you know, sharing anything that's confidential.
Right.
Because we know what deals are getting done at if we're just acting even as just as the business valuation advisor and not even the M&A advisor. We still know what deals are getting done at.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So Does the valuation arm work closely with the investment banking arm?
They do. A lot of times we borrow their resources. If we're doing what we call a preliminary business valuation for a client, which is something that we don't charge for, we might leverage their resources and their expertise to make sure that we're doing it the right way and that we're on track.
What are you seeing the multiples for government contractors in the M&A area be? I mean, what are the multiples today?
Well, we always like to say that the rule of five is you start at 5x EBITDA until proven otherwise. And so proven otherwise could be if you have some of these highly valuable contracts and cleared people, for example, in the federal space, you know, maybe that creeps up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10x EBITDA. And on the lower end, if it's just more of a, if it's something less differentiated, it might only be 1 to 2x EBITDA.
Really?
Yeah.
Somebody would actually sell for 1 to 2x EBITDA?
Well, that's a good question. Sometimes they don't.
Are the sellers finding that the buyers are there? Are there buyers out there right
they
now?
They are. They are, but they're just much more cautious with, you know, we've had this election uncertainty, and so it's really put a lot of cash on the sidelines, and it's made them a little bit slower to act, but
do you think the cash is going to be released between now and the end of the year?
No, probably not, except for deals that are already in motion. I mean, if they're not in due diligence at this point, then it's just too late in the year. But we do expect to see a slight uptick next year because the election uncertainty is behind us.
So if you want to talk to an investment banker at McLean Group, you want to talk to Brent Lorenz, how do you get in touch with you?
Sure, Brent? Thanks. Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. You can find me on LinkedIn, which is Brent Lorenz, L-O-R-E-N-Z. My Twitter handle is @TechMergers. And you can also email me at blorenz@mcleanllc.com.
Excellent. Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me.
And you can hear Brent on the archives of Blueprint for Wealth on federalnewsradio.com or on blueprintforwealth.org. Join me next week for another special topic and special guest. I'm Wayne Zell, and sponsored by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.